This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. Chris Steele, a former officer at MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Service, and the co-founder of Orbis, a private intelligence company, is best known as the author of the 2016 Trump-Russia dossier, containing allegations of links between members of Donald Trump's presidential election campaign and agents of the Russian government. The report led to the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel to investigate the allegations of Russian interference in the campaign. I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be joined for this Infotagen podcast by Chris Steele for his first on-the-record broadcast interview to discuss his insights based on over 30 years of experience in countering Russian networks of influence and disinformation. We'll also be hearing from the journalist Luke Harding, whose latest book, Shadow State, Murder, Mayhem, and Russia's Remaking of the West, was published last month, as well as from our resident disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Chris Steele, it's fantastic to have you on the Infotagen podcast. A lot of what we've discussed in the past about campaigns of disinformation and indeed the work of the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee looking at disinformation took us back to Russia and the role of Russia and its networks in spreading campaigns of disinformation. This is not a new phenomenon. It's something that you and your professional career have tracked for some time. I mean, when did you first become aware of certainly Russian disinformation moving into the social media space beyond the traditional media channels that are deployed during the Cold War?
Thank you, Damon, for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. I think although you've been mainly focused on sort of modern version of disinformation and fake news and all the rest of it, I think you do have to go back into the past and look at where this sort of emerged from. And certainly it was part of the old KGB's playbook back in the sort of 1970s and 80s. I mean, you remember very well the story about how the KGB tried to spread disinformation in the 1980s, that the AIDS epidemic was something that had been started as a result of American biological weapons research. And I think that kind of example illustrates the way in which this is targeted. So I also think it's, although that was, of course, completely false, disinformation is a slightly kind of misnomer, really, because I would say it's misleading information. And I say that because in my experience of this, which goes back more than 30 years, into the Soviet period, a lot of the information that was given out by them with a purpose, with a political or counterintelligence purpose in mind, was actually true, or was largely true. And what you had to do is kind of read between the lines in sense of what's missing here, what's been overemphasized, what's been underemphasized. You know, you might, for example, have a weapon system that was said to have a range of 20 miles when its range was actually 25 miles, which would encourage the enemy in closer and could be destroyed. So I think it's quite a sort of back history of this. I think what's changed is that in the old days, the objectives of disinformation or slanted information or planted information, maybe a better term, was largely to do with military affairs and largely to do with counterintelligence work. And I think the big difference is that in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, it's kind of bled into more mainstream life, political life, news, the media, particularly social media. And it's become a much more sort of all-encompassing playbook and approach to trying to achieve your political and social and economic objectives. So that's how I would see it coming on. I think that it was largely trialled, and Luke will know about this, is coming on, but it was largely trialled in the near abroad, as they call it, Georgia, Ukraine, and so on, probably from about 2004, possibly from the Orange Revolution onwards. And it's kind of grown and spread like a sort of contagion out into, like a pandemic even, out into Western Europe and into the Western world and the Western democracies. And I think it's even reached into the private sector now, where the same playbook is being used in something called black PR, which is a feature of Russian business life and business life associated with Russian actors.
I mean, should we regard Russian disinformation and interference in elections, particularly political disinformation, as a direct threat to democracy? And do you think the UK is a particularly strong target of these Russian operations?
It depends what you mean by a direct threat to democracy. I think that I think what it does is it undermines people's faith in democracy and its trust in democracy, in particular in elections, which, as I've said before, should be the apogee of our democracy, not the weak point of it. The other thing I think it's designed to do in its modern form is to create great polarity, great partisanship and divisions within political life, which we've not seen in democracies before. I mean, I think this is particularly bad in the United States, obviously, and it was summed up to me by that T-shirt that some Republican activists were wearing at one of Trump's rallies, in which it said something on the T-shirt like, better a Russian than a Democrat. And that's where we've got to in America. And obviously, I'm very concerned that we don't get to that point in this country, that national security issues can be bipartisan and that we can keep our politics moderate and mainstream for the most part, despite Russia and other actors, foreign actors, attempts to polarise us.
I mean, it seems to be a legitimate concern to ask who is looking out for this? Because I remember when I was chair of the Select Committee asking Facebook about, was there any equivalent evidence of Russian interference in UK elections, similar to what had been discovered in America? And Facebook said to me, well, unless you can prove that it happened or you've got an intelligence report showing it happened, then we won't look. And indeed, they're under no obligation to look. But if the intelligence community aren't looking or the government isn't looking, then who is? And I thought this was something very interesting coming out of the Russia report when it was published, that there seemed to be a lack of interest in finding evidence of this activity.
I think it has to stem from policy. You know, if you are talking about the intelligence agencies, for example, in this country, they have to be tasked specifically to go after this kind of material. And it's very difficult to quantify as well. Clearly, you know, it's incredibly difficult to say what the quantitative impact of this kind of disinformation and fake news is. But in general, in the West, I think it's fair to say that a lot of our elections are closely fought and rely on sort of a very small swing element of the population in order to produce a majority for one party or another. Certainly in America in 2016, it was 70,000 votes out of 120 million or something. So I think it can have a very pernicious effect. But I think it's not just elections. I think it's the way in which the political discourse and the political parties are kind of pushed out to the extremes. And the consensus view on things like national security and the integrity of the United Kingdom and its defence and things which, in general, in recent times have been pretty much consensus issues. There's now a definite attempt to shatter those. And, you know, Brexit, in a way, whatever you think of Brexit, was a classic case of that. But I think we're seeing a greater threat of issues becoming more and more divisive as we go through. And the pandemic, by and large, in Britain has been handled fairly consensually, I think. But in America, obviously, it hasn't at all. And the same polarisation that we saw between Trump and Clinton in 2016 is now playing out over there, and no doubt encouraged by Russia and other authoritarian states intervening, to be yet another sort of hugely divisive force in their national life, to weaken them as societies and as world powers.
And in your view, is that a good enough objective for Russia, that actually if it can achieve division in Western countries, weakening the confidence of the public in government and other public institutions, and leaving people in a position where they largely don't know what to believe or who to trust on major issues, that for the Russians is a good result?
It's a very good result. I mean, it's obviously not the only thing they're trying to achieve in the West. I mean, they want to have their cake and eat it. They want to be able to pursue a sort of nationalist populist policy at home to cover up elite corruption, but they also want to be able to siphon their money out into places like Britain in particular, unseen and uncriticised. And so it is only part of their weaponry or their armour, but it's an important one. It's one that's growing all the time. I mean, I remember in the past we used to talk about the Russian Federation, Soviet Union, is there was a mismatch between intent and capability. And certainly in economic terms and even in military terms, in many ways, Russia is not a particularly strong country. But with the advent of this kind of opportunity, if you like, asymmetric opportunity, where the rules go out the window and cyber and fake news and all the rest of it come to the fore, that enables, I think, Russia to meet much more of its intent by its capability than was in the case in the past.
And in your experience, in terms of the Russian strategy behind these things, I mean, do you feel that they will experiment with different approaches and then double down on the things that they think work? So if, for example, they think that exploiting social media and other tools to create divisions in Western countries is a successful strategy, then they will pursue more of it.
Yes, I mean, I think there's always a debate. It's not a monolithic country. It's not even a monolithic regime. You know, within the regime, as I often like it to an Ottoman court, there are arguments for being more or less aggressive and more or less proactive in some of these areas. Is it really necessary to interfere in the US election that's coming up, for example, given that just how, you know, the US politicians themselves are creating these divisions without too much prompting from elsewhere? But I think so they don't like getting caught, they don't like getting exposed in this area, and so they will take into account the risk of being so. And I think, you know, their response and their actions will be proportionate to A, the risk of being uncovered, and B, what the retaliation would be. And my argument would be that the retaliation has been wholly inadequate to this new phenomenon, this new threat to our way of life, which has encouraged them on. It's encouraged the hawks in the regime to push for more interference rather than less.
I mean, you were very clear in your written evidence to the Russia report, which was published shortly after the report was published, about the need for, you know, greater resources to be committed to countering the threat, and also about what the nature of the threat is in terms of the targeting of influential individuals in the UK, the use of social media to disseminate disinformation campaigns, and indeed, obviously, you know, you were, I would imagine, hired to prepare the Trump dossier on the basis of your expert knowledge of Russian influence campaigns. Why do you think we're in a position where we seem to have left ourselves so open and so weak to countering with this threat? Why has more not been done to give a more robust response?
I think that we've been generally behind the curve. I think I referred to six paradigm shifting events in recent history involving Russian rogue behavior in my submission. And those events took me by surprise. So if they took me by surprise and people who are experts in this area, then it's quite an ask to think that the whole government and its bureaucracy and the media will be catching up with what's going on. I think one of the problems has been that the threat and the way it's carried out has been two steps ahead of everybody else. I also think it's quite a difficult thing to counter because it's often done remotely. It evolves. So a lot of the bot farms and all the rest of it are either farmed out to ostensibly non-state actors in Russia or indeed other countries. And, you know, one of the things that was interesting recently, I think, was the uncovering of a bot farm, I think, in Ghana, where some African guy had been a student in Moscow, clearly recruited there, sent back home to set up a sort of attack base from there into America. So they're very much adaptable, and they're very aggressive, and they're very much ahead of the curve to catch up with them. And I think that's one of the problems. One of the problems has always been that intelligence agencies, and indeed diplomacy, have focused largely on the clear state actors and the clear state apparatus without being able to move out into the sort of parastatal zone, which is, I think, where a lot of this activity, this new activity, is being conducted from, partly for reasons of plausible deniability, but also because the skill set is probably better in that zone than it is in the state zone.
I mean, something you talked about in your evidence, and indeed, I suppose the Trump dossier is in itself an example of this, is the danger of the Russians seeking to corrupt high-profile people in public life in the UK. And we've been talking now about sort of disinformation campaigns that could be targeted at a population or aspects of a population. But this, I suppose, is a much more discrete threat. And again, do you feel that this is something that requires more attention?
Yes, I do. And I think actually it's interesting that having left government in 2009 and having operated in the private sector ever since and having done, you know, a lot of work around Russia and Russia business and Russian legal disputes and things like that, I think, you know, we've got a perspective on this, me and similar colleagues who've done similar things in the private sector, that perhaps government doesn't have. And actually it was one of the great strengths of the late Sir Charles Farr is that he realised this quite a while ago and was involved in outreach to companies like ours to try and glean our knowledge of how this, I mean, this sort of phenomenon was mutating and changing its shape and how much insight into that we might gain from the private sector sort of angles. So yes, I think it's something which is radically different from what it was 10 or 15 years ago. It has been pretty effective and it's not being properly countered because of a lack of experience and imagination. And I would argue possibly a lack of skill in the core institutions of government where there's been a lot of brain drain, if you like, of people out of government, out of the intelligence services and diplomacy, because they're, you know, moving into the private sector. On the other hand, you know, to some extent, people were operating in the private sector are also part of the problem, or can be, either through naivety or through design. And this is why I think that, you know, obviously a topic we should come on to, things like the Foreign Agent Registration Act and so on, yes, are really seriously required quite urgently in this country now.
Absolutely. And the Americans have had that since the 1930s, and we still don't have the equivalent. But I mean, you say that people, there's a lack of knowledge and expertise. When it became, certainly looking at the work you did looking at Russia in preparing the Trump dossier, when it became known that you and your firm had been involved in that, when it became publicly known, were you approached privately by people in the government or people in the service to say, you know, what are you picking up? You know, what should we be looking for that we may be not spotting? Was there any attempt to understand what it was that you were seeing that maybe others weren't?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I obviously can't say too much about the specifics of that. But I think, as I indicated earlier, there were people in government at the time, including the late Sir Charles Farr, who had this in their sights. I think there's not been a systematic engagement since he passed away in terms of, you know, gleaning what we have got and what we find out and what we hear. And there are reasons for that, but they're not good enough, I don't think, in order for them not to justify non-engagement. One of the reasons is obviously that people always want to know who your sources are so they can check them out, and you're going to be reluctant to give up your best sort of intellectual property assets in that context. But I think as professionals working in the private sector, we do have a lot to offer in that regard. And I think that the exigence of needing to understand what's going on out there is greater than the risk of, you know, embarrassing stories in the media about engagement with people like us and so on and so forth. So I think it's something that is fairly urgently required.
Absolutely. And it does seem concerning if the response sometimes to these things, you know, the issues that were raised, have been raised by your work, particularly to the much discussed Trump dossier, are potentially extremely serious matters that are not of interest of discrete matters of policy, but maybe quite fundamental issues about whether Russia has exerted influence or has the power to exert influence over high-profile individuals. And you feel there might be a higher level of concern about that. And what we've seen largely as a response from some people is largely just to rubbish the work and rubbish the whole idea. And then it's even more concerning when we see coming out of the Russia report, the suggestion that people aren't that interested in delving any deeper into these issues.
I'm not sure they're not interested. I think it's difficult for a number of reasons. And one is that, you know, the Crown servants and the diplomats don't like to sort of tread into areas that are highly sensitive politically. And I think, you know, it's almost easier for people running political parties in this country to go to the security service rather than the security service to go to them, because they're going to always fear that the security, the politicians are going to fear that the security services are stepping outside the bounds of where they should be operating. And certainly the advice I've given when I've briefed senior politicians in Britain of all parties is, you know, you need to be proactive as well about this. You need to be vigilant as well. And you need to be approaching the security service and the diplomatic service and foreign intelligence to keep your own houses in good order, because certainly what started off, I believe, as a sort of softening up, I would say, rather than corruption necessarily, of our regulatory authorities in the noughties, when there was a sort of anything goes regulation happening to attract foreign investment, has now bled over into political life. And, you know, all political parties are being targeted in one way or another. And I think they need to wake up to this, and they need to be proactive in countering it. Because whether it's donations on the Conservative side or leaking of documents that are used in election campaigns on the Labour side through hacking or whatever, it needs to be an organised effort, counter effort, to make sure that this doesn't distort and disrupt our political life.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up the documents used by the Labour Party in the election, which we now know came from the hacking of a cabinet minister's email account by the Russians, which is obviously extremely serious. It makes you wonder what other information they have access to. We obviously saw recently as well the hack of verified accounts on Twitter. We're coming up to another election cycle in America in November. Are you concerned about the vulnerability of that election to interference from Russia? And do you think we may see, as we saw in 2016, hacked documents being released during the campaign to try and embarrass candidates?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, I think, you know, issues like the Black Lives Matter that's going on at the moment, and certainly trying to sow racial discord, I think that's already been reported into the congressional committees by the agencies in America as an area of concern in terms of foreign interference. And foreign governments have big stakes in this American election that's coming up, particularly the authoritarian ones. And they're going to be very concerned at the idea that the apple cart might be tipped up by Biden winning. I mean, we've already seen a really significant effort through Ukraine of Russian disinformation coming out to try and discredit Biden and his son and Burisma and all the rest of it. And so I do expect to see more of this down the trail towards November. And from what I understand, I'm not a technician, but from what I understand, not a huge amount has been done to protect the integrity of the infrastructure and the election itself by Congress. And the problem is that the appearance certainly is that the Republicans in Congress think this is going to assist them and help them, and therefore they're not going to do very much about it. And I fear that we might see that coming over this side of the Atlantic at some point, which is why I'm so determined and to brief and to be non-partisan in our approach to helping political parties with this and helping the government with it.
But from what you said, it sounds like, you know, we can't just leave this to the intelligence community and the service. This does require politicians making this a priority as well.
Yes, particularly those that are sort of running, if you like, the main political parties. You know, in the case of the Conservatives 1922 Committee or whatever, similarly with the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, it is there are huge vulnerabilities that are created by democracy and by modern technology, and we're not catching up quickly enough with how our adversaries are able to and willing to exploit those things without really strong retaliation and deterrence existing.
I'd just like to bring Luke Harding into the conversation at this point, who's been listening to our discussion. I mean, Luke, you've written extensively on this, and indeed, you know, worked with Christiel on some of your published work and books as well. I'd be very interested to hear your reflections on what Chris has said, but also it struck me again, looking at the Russia report when it was published, a lot of what it covers isn't new, and it's been known about for a while, but yet we're still asking ourselves a question, or asking our governments the question, and other politicians the question, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, Damien. And it's interesting hearing Chris talk about this. And I think one thing you have to understand about Vladimir Putin is that he's an equal opportunity wrecker. In other words, just because he or his operatives support your cause this time round, it doesn't mean that they're going to support your cause next time round. And it's very short-sighted. I mean, Chris talks about the Republicans in the US in the upcoming November election there to not try and tackle this problem as a whole, because it does affect everybody. It is a bipartisan problem. And I was quite surprised by the Russia report, by the fact that essentially what the committee was saying was that there hadn't been a kind of proper interrogation of an alleged Kremlin role influence campaign in the run-up to the EU referendum of 2016. Wherever you stand on Brexit, it's pretty clear that the Russians were pushing for it, because from Moscow, Brexit is a highly desired foreign policy outcome. It estranges London from Paris and Berlin. It weakens European unity. Obviously, the Russians want to see sanctions removed, which were imposed after the annexation of Crimea and the war there in 2014. But I was a bit dismayed by the reaction from the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who was basically saying, look, this is a load of kind of moaning Remainers who refuse to accept the verdict. Because I can envisage a scenario here where, let's say, we have a sort of second Scottish independence referendum a few years down the road where Russia's always in favor of secessionism in other countries, not at home in Chechnya, but in places like Catalonia and Scotland. But I can see a big, certainly a social media operation, possibly a political operation in support of Scottish independence, which is obviously something this government doesn't want to see. And so we've got to be mindful of this. I would endorse what Chris said earlier on about the whole social media operation. I think what's been really striking as someone who has followed Russian interference over a period of years is how it's improved. When I was a Guardian correspondent in Moscow, 2007, 2008, 2009, I was kicked out eventually in 2011. It was interesting that the trolls then, the social media operatives, they'd mastered Russian language space, and they had just started posting comments on The Guardian or The Telegraph or The New York Times. And these were in kind of clunky English. They were obviously done by bots. But with time, they got better, to the point that when you look at what happened in 2016, when you had trolls posting in support of Brexit and in support of Donald Trump, very often I suspect the same trolls, their English had improved. They were pretending to be, you know, Andrew or David or whatever. And it was more sophisticated. And the big point is that, as Chris says, you know, Putin is using the classic Soviet playbook to try and divide and disorientate and undermine Western societies and to squash the moderate center, to push extremes. But he's doing it with a verve, a finesse that eluded his KGB predecessors. And most of all, he's got the reach. Thanks to Facebook and Twitter, he can try and play with people's heads, to mess with people's heads. And I think we need to be kind of robust as citizens, as voters, as parliamentarians, to push back against this. Otherwise, it's going to become the new normal.
And they must also take some comfort, I think, from the fact that when people do try and call this out and question it and criticize it, then they themselves become the subject of considerable attack and abuse within their own country.
Yeah, I mean, I feel rather sorry for Chris. I mean, Chris will be able to say how many times President Donald Trump has tweeted kind of abusive stuff at him, but it must be running into the hundreds by now. I mean, we're all big, we're all kind of grown-ups in this world, but it must be pretty discomforting. And actually, I get a fair amount of trolling, and it's obvious that not all of it, but quite a lot of it is systematic. I imagine you do get it too, and it's one of the most toxic elements of 21st century life. And it would be okay if this was just like an annoying fly that buzzed at you and you swatted away. But the problem is it's instrumentalized. The view in Moscow is that these social media campaigns work. And what we've seen in the last few years are these highly contested, highly divisive elections whether it's the last US poll, whether it's the Brexit referendum, where Russia will weigh in on one side for its own strategic advantage. And we've got to be clear, you know, Vladimir Putin is not a genius. He's not sitting in Moscow, flicking switches, making things happen in London or Edinburgh or Washington. He's not the master of everything, but he's a kind of classic KGB opportunist and adventurist who will try stuff which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, and exploits the open nature of our societies, the porousness of Western democracies, and turns it back against us. And we are in a very precarious time, I would say.
And indeed, the tensions around coronavirus have probably brought that to a head again. And indeed, there seem to be evidence of crossover between movements on social media, particularly on Facebook, that flip from talking about coronavirus, anti-mask, anti-vaccine, Black Lives Matter, and other political issues as well, and in a way that seems to be coordinated and sustained.
Yes, I think that's right, Damien. And I think what Putin wants to do and his kind of operatives is supercharge the conversation. It's like, you know, there is a fire. Putin didn't start the fire, but he's kind of paraphernizing the fire so it burns more brightly. And so that means it becomes harder to have a reasonable, decent, bipartisan conversation. And I think that's quite dangerous. And the reason he does this, the reason he wants turmoil in Western countries is because while we're kind of preoccupied with our own internal conversations and debates, while we can't even agree on science or medicine or whether we should wear a mask or not, it means that Russia can do its sort of sovereign thing around the world almost unnoticed and undetected, and is emboldened to do things in the near abroad. And if Trump wins a second term, I would be very nervous if I were sitting in a Baltic country, or maybe in Ukraine. I think it's quite possible something else could happen again there. But also, Russia is kind of operating globally. It's playing an increasingly big role in Libya, in Syria already, where there've been military operations for a couple of years, in the Central African Republic and other African countries. And as Chris was saying earlier, this is often done in a parastatal way. It's done by oligarchs, by intermediaries. It's done deniably. And that was one of the things that struck me about Chris's evidence to Parliament and to the Intelligence and Security Committee, was there's a sort of idea that Russian spying is done in London by generals with big eyebrows and olive green uniforms and sort of rattling medals. It's not. It's done by charming, plausible, clever, English-speaking intermediaries who read novels, who are very decent, but actually ultimately are working for a hostile state that wishes the UK and the US ill. And we need to be careful. And these same people, whether they're oligarchs or career intelligence officers, have enriched the City of London, that they've paid huge numbers of fees to lawyers, to accountants, to real estate people, to private school headmasters. And this is partly a story about not just faraway corruption, but the ability to corrode our own societies here at home.
Absolutely. And actually, on that point, I mean, Chris, if I come back to you on that, you mentioned it earlier on, I meant to follow up, was the, you mentioned the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which the American, exists in American law. We don't have the equivalent here. I agree with you, and I think we should introduce that, and I'm pleased to see the government has spoken, suggesting that it will. What sort of powers do you think that would give us now that we don't have? Do you think it's an effective response?
The obvious answer to that is it depends how it's framed and how it's implemented. I mean, one of the surprising things about the Bribery Act that was introduced, I think in 2012, is that because it was really quite hard-nosed, it hasn't been implemented very much, and I'm not sure the extent to which it's therefore served as a deterrent compared with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of the US, which is actually used and deployed quite widely, and certainly in my experience acts as a deterrent. So I think it's all about framing. I absolutely agree it's necessary. The Australians have brought one in much more recently that's perhaps more appropriate for a modern society, because the American one has been updated, but started in the 1930s, my understanding, to prevent the Nazis from Germany proselytizing and paying agents in the United States. So, yes, there's a whole range of things that you can do. I think your colleague in Parliament, Bob Seeley, has a paper that's circulating at the moment, which has a sort of hard, medium and soft options. And, you know, having had a look at that, I think, and I would recommend other people do look at it. For me, the middle course, the medium option is the one which retains some criminal sanctions, but also some civil sanction, but also defines reasonably clearly what you're talking about as a sort of state actor. You know, if you've got a majority state-owned enterprise in a critical sector of the economy, or a government largely funded organisation, like Ross Sotrunich, for example, in the case of Russia, then I think you do create a good deal of deterrence, and you do create the environment which doesn't just snuff out free speech or an enterprise, but does give you greater security. And of course, underlying all this is a tension, and we have to admit it's there, between the wealth creation sort of agenda of a government and its national security agenda. And particularly post-Brexit, where obviously we do want to attract foreign investment, but not at any price, and not if it leads to the distortion and corruption of our political life.
Well, indeed, I think we've seen from some of the recent investigations into donations and whether donations were made from overseas, which is against the law, that actually if someone in another country is prepared to give someone in the UK some money, on the understanding that they will donate that to a political party, there's nothing in our system that really stops you doing that, even though that would be clearly a massive abuse.
I agree. And I think the other thing we have to be very careful of is taking at face value, you know, somebody who becomes a British citizen and claims to be a dissident. I mean, my experience is that all Russians are either afraid of the Kremlin or indeed, as part of that, trying to reinsure or have a situation where they can trade something with the Kremlin if the rainy day arrives. So I think we've got to be very cautious of all that and of, you know, all the loopholes that clearly are there, where a foreign citizen has a British registered company and the British registered company gives the donation. The donation is not discovered until several months after it's been made, which can be that the donation has been made before a general election, doesn't come to light until after that general election, and so on. I mean, I think it's you've just got to get wise to what the different loopholes are and try and close them.
Absolutely. And I mean, Charles Krill, you've been listening in as always on our podcast. It's great to have you with us again. Just as we've been going through this, I've been thinking about some of our previous work. I was thinking about Dr. Kogan, who, remember, the man at the center of the Cambridge Analytica Facebook data scraping scandal, who at the same time was also, you know, received funding from the Russian state to do research into cyberbullying at the University of St. Petersburg. There seem to be plenty of people that move effortlessly between these different worlds. Well, what are your thoughts listening to what Chris and what Luke have had to say?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts listening to it, and some questions come to mind as well. I mean, one thing, if we say Dr. Kogan or almost anybody else who we know has been operating and may well have been funded as well, as if Russia is so keen not to be caught interfering in elections, I wonder, one, why do we keep catching them? But also what kind of methods they may be developing now to go undetected, given that it's clear that everyone's eye is on them at the moment. And the other thing that really came to mind listening is that I wonder how destabilization of the West doesn't undermine what Chris spoke about both pursuing a national populist policy, but at the same time siphoning money out to the West. And if it's not undermined, what does an end game look like, both for the Kremlin court and for Russia as a country?
I think that's a really, really interesting question. I mean, Chris, what do you think the end game is for the Russians, or is there not necessarily an end game?
I don't think they have a great strategy, actually. I think they're very tactical in the way that they approach these things. It's a typical KGB mentality. It comprises of being tactical and opportunistic, of not actually wanting to get caught in most instances, and of over-personalizing everything. And this is what they do. And Russia is run by intelligence officers, for good or bad. And, you know, they've fanned out into all the big state enterprises. You know, you've got people at Rosneft and, you know, the State Arms Corporation, other places, in the banks even, being run by former Carter intelligence officers. And so you have to understand that mentality. What does a good outcome look like for Putin and co is basically a sort of permanent tactical advantage. They're clearly not leading Russia to any great strategic future or strategic strength. But what they are concerned about is protecting their own backs and their own wealth. And the way in which they do that, obviously, is by successfully siphoning it away from the risk of instability back home as much as they can, and of keeping the sort of West either divided or distracted or anesthetized to what they're actually doing. And I think, you know, the whole issue of unexplained wealth orders, of uncovering ultimate beneficial ownership, of the way in which sanctions have been dodged by giving assets over to people's nephews and son-in-laws and a whole sort of princeling class, even going as far as divorcing your wife if it means that you can protect a large part of your assets from OFAC and sanctions. So I think it's, I don't see it as some great game, some great end game. I see it as tactical survival and prosperity and a way in which they can stay in power, because if you're in a country like Russia or China, you have to stay in power. There's no question that that's the fundamental point. And the other point I was going to make, I haven't had a chance to yet, was that I think a number of other leading authoritarian countries are taking note of what Russia's doing and Russia's been seen to achieve and are following suit. I think I did make some reference to it in terms of 2020 in America, but I think more generally, I think this playbook is catching on because it's seen to be quite effective.
Can I just jump in? I agree with Chris, and I think what's interesting is that this particular bunch of Russian leaders who are, as Chris says, basically KGB, they are more vulnerable in a way that their predecessors are not, because the project at home is this kind of noisy revisionist nationalism of Crimea is ours, of imperial restoration, of Russia being a great power again under Vladimir Putin after two decades. But actually what we know is that Putin's sort of friends, they're all multi-billionaires and they have enormous numbers of assets in the West. They have yachts parked off Corsica, they have wine collections in Switzerland, they have property in central London, often family over here as well. And that does give us purchase. If there's political will, there are all sorts of things that the British government can do. And I'll just say lastly, I mean, I was one of a big group of investigative reporters who did the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers, which was a leak of millions of offshore documents. And I was just struck how the Kremlin leadership, including Vladimir Putin or people close to him, his best friend, Sergei Roldugin, were using British companies, British corporate structures registered at Companies House, accountants sitting in the Isle of Man, trust funds in Jersey, to hide their wealth, or in overseas territories such as the British Virgin Islands. And so if government were to go after these illicit funds to expose them or to confiscate them and to ban Russian kind of political elite people from traveling to the UK, then that would be an enormously effective weapon. But so far, I haven't seen any kind of great appetite from the government to do this, but the route is there should they choose to take it.
I mean, and have you seen that in other countries? I mean, I think, you know, you've written a lot about Russian influence in countries like Cyprus and elsewhere, and we know the extensive Russian interference networks in Eastern Europe. We've talked about that on the podcast before. Do you think there's been a more effective response elsewhere?
Well, I mean, I think all politicians and kind of financial agencies are trying to grapple with the problem of how you deal with a aggressive, angry, irrational zero sum Russia. I mean, it's a strategic problem for everybody. But in terms of the kind of the financial aspect, a few countries have done better. I mean, after the Panama Papers came out, the German tax piece raided a few banks, kicked some doors in, arrested people. And in this country, we really didn't do that. I mean, one or two solicitors who had been involved in pretty egregious cases featuring the daughters of the Azerbaijan president were belatedly hauled up and fined. But there was nothing on a kind of huge scale. And my understanding is that these sort of the weaknesses in the British corporate system, where there are a few checks, no one ever follows up, and the NCA, the National Crime Agency, is under-resourced, that our mechanism is not adequate to the problem. I mean, London is the money laundering center of the world, pretty much. I mean, if it's an octopus or a giant vampire squid with its tentacles around the globe, London is the sort of the cephalopod brain and beak. So we have enormous power theoretically, but a lot of people who are called out in the Russia report, intermediaries, facilitators, have grown quite rich on this tide of money. Not all of it corrupt, but a lot of it corrupt, coming from the East. And my fear is that when Brexit happens and this country is in a pretty weak economic state, the temptation will be to roll out the red carpet for kleptocrats or for other foreign billionaires, asking a few questions about where their funds come from.
And I mean, Chris, you touched as well on the sort of Russia playbook, the playbook of nationalism and populism, and that's being adopted in other countries. I mean, which countries in particular give you concern?
I thought you might ask me that. I think the countries which come to mind, obviously China is one, possibly Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and other countries who have a vested interest in not too much transparency going on over large amounts of wealth and indeed sort of the way in which foreign policy is decided and carried out. And it's no surprise that this sort of wave of authoritarianism that seems to have enveloped large parts of the world in the last 5 to 10 years is kind of changing the map and is in a way making us far less confident, I think, in ourselves. I mean, you look out from this country and you don't have to go very far before you come across some people in governments which are ostensibly democratic, which are very disturbing, you know, even places like Poland and Italy. And so we're on the defensive. The people that believe in the liberal democratic values, transparency, anti-corruption, and all the rest of it are much on the back foot at the moment. And, you know, even in this country, I don't sense there is a great kind of well of a rush of sort of strength and opinion to push back at this. And I think, you know, we've got countries in Europe like Italy, like Austria, who we've been very close to for decades. So we, you know, I remember the wall coming down and the Velvet Revolution, all the rest of it. These countries have slipped back under authoritarian rule internally and allegiances east externally, almost unperceived by certainly the majority of people in political and media life. And it's really quite worrying.
I mean, do you think the West is weaker now than it's been at any point since the Cold War?
Yes, without doubt. And I'm not sure that the West as a concept, as opposed to, say, liberal democracy or whatever, quite makes the same sort of sense that it did. I mean, you look at NATO. Turkey is technically a member of NATO and always was a pretty hard-nosed member of NATO up until fairly recently. Now it's just ploughing its own furrow and doing things in Syria and Iraq and so on, which you couldn't have imagined them sort of getting away with buying Russian weaponry. You know, our international sort of internationalist institutions and alliances that we've relied on for 70 years to keep peace and prosperity are either weakened or destroyed, I think, in this sort of wave of popular nationalism that we have experienced. And I think the handling of the pandemic, if to go off the topic slightly, just shows you how fragmented the international community has become.
And I mean, you've mentioned a number of countries there who are NATO, part of the NATO alliance. I mean, does that mean from an intelligence point of view, there are countries that are our allies, but whom we wouldn't feel confident sharing intelligence information?
I wouldn't. I mean, you know, other people make other judgments, but certainly there are countries in NATO that I wouldn't feel comfortable sharing intelligence with on, say, Russia, quite clearly. I mean, counterterrorism is slightly different, but certainly from a counterintelligence point of view, I would be pretty cautious with some of these people and these governments, yeah.
And I mean, just as we sort of come to a close, I mean, given everything we've talked about at the moment, Christelle, what keeps you awake at night?
Worrying what my kids are doing out at nightclubs, though thankfully the pandemic's put an end to that. No, I think what keeps me awake at night is the erosion of our basic values and institutions. The lack of leadership of the United States, which has been our staunch ally in these areas for decades. And I think the complacency in many ways and the sort of inward-lookingness of even our country and our government, which, and we've been, you know, one of the most important internationalist forces since the Second World War. That's what keeps me awake at night, that we're actually losing this battle and half the people that should be fighting it and not even aware it's really going on.
Thank you. Chris Steele, Luke Harding, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring Chris Steele, Luke Harding, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.